Thank you for joining us. This broadcast has been made possible by the Lord and by the generous donations of brethren like you. If you would like to give a donation to help keep this broadcast on the air, please visit llgive.com. Thank you, and shalom. Welcome back to Chapter and Verse. This is episode 2 of our discussion about the Sabbath. What is Shabbat exactly? What are the commands concerning Shabbat? How would we apply those commands to our 21st century lives? In the last episode, we began working our way through the scriptures, looking at the verses that spoke about Shabbat. We left off discussing Numbers chapter 15. For this episode, we'll go ahead and move to the next set of scripture verses that speak about Shabbat. As we move forward through the Bible, the next mention of the Sabbath occurs in Deuteronomy chapter 5, verses 12 through 15. This passage in Deuteronomy reads, "Observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy, as Adonai your Elohim commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of Adonai your Elohim. In it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter or your male servant or your female servant or your ox or your donkey or any of your cattle or your sojourner who stays with you, so that your male servant and your female servant may rest as well as you. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and Adonai your Elohim brought you out of there by a mighty hand and by an outstretched arm. Therefore, Adonai your Elohim commanded you to observe the Sabbath day." Okay, there's a lot to cover from this passage. First, we see this passage opens up with the eighth time in the Torah where we are instructed to keep the Sabbath holy. I'm just going to take a wild stab in the dark here, but I'm pretty sure that when Adonai says every time that he talks about the Shabbat that it's holy, and he instructs us to maintain its holiness, we might want to take that seriously. Next, we see in verse 13 that he states that we should labor for 6 days, but that is then followed up with an additional clarifier, do all your work. Specifically, verse 13 states, "Sheshet yamim ta'avod vasit kal melachtecha." This is literally, 6 days, serve and do all your work. I highlight the Hebrew here to make several points. There's an inference that's being made here. By stating 6 days work or 6 days serve, there are 6 days on which work is acceptable according to this. But that we could also safely infer by reasonable deduction, by that statement, it's saying that work is not to be done on the seventh day if all work is to be done on the 6 days. This then is further reinforced by the phrase, do all your work. The word used here in verse 13 to convey all is the Hebrew word kal. This word means, most appropriately, everything. We can see it being used this way over 5,000 times in the Tanakh. Here are just a few examples. Genesis chapter 1, verse 21. "Elohim created the great sea monsters and kal nefesh, every living creature that moves, with which the water swarmed after their kind, and kal of, every winged bird after its kind, and Elohim saw that it was good." 4 verses later in Genesis chapter 1, verse 25, it says, "Elohim made the beasts of the earth after their kind, the cattle after their kind, and kal remes, everything that creeps on the ground after its kind, and Elohim saw that it was good." So in both of these verses, in 3 different instances, we have this word kal being used to describe everything. Every living creature of the waters, every bird, every creature that creeps on the ground. Unless we assume that Elohim didn't create all living things, or that somehow some creatures came along after the fact that aren't part of this list, then we have to assume that this word everything means everything. We see this word used again in the next chapter, in Genesis chapter 2, verse 1, where it says, "Thus the heavens and the earth were completed, v'kal tzava'am, and all their hosts." Should we assume that Elohim made more after he created the heavens and the earth and all their hosts? Was he not done with creating everything on the 6th day, like it says here? This, of course, is then followed up with the next verses, verses 2 and 3, which we read in our last episode. "By the 7th day, Elohim completed his work which he had done, and he rested on the 7th day. Mikal melakto, from all his work which he had done. Then Elohim blessed the 7th day and sanctified it, because in it he rested mikal melakto, from all his work which Elohim had created and made. So again, do we assume that he had more work to be done with creation after the first 6 days, despite what these verses are saying? Of course not. But did you catch the repetition of a Hebrew phrase that links Genesis chapter 2 and Deuteronomy chapter 5? It said in Genesis chapter 2, verses 2 and in verse 3, that Elohim rested mikal melakto, from all his work. Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 13 says, 6 days you shall labor and do kal melaktecha, all your work. The only difference between these verses is the mem before the word kal in Genesis, which means from, and the tense in which it is written. In Genesis, the word work, melakto, is written in the third person singular. In Deuteronomy, the word work, melaktecha, is written in the third person plural. Both passages, though, say all work. In Genesis, what is described is that Adonai had finished all his work on the sixth day and rested on the seventh. In Deuteronomy, we are instructed to follow the example he himself set for us, specifically to finish all our work in 6 days and then to rest on the seventh. Should this mean that we don't have to work again on the first day of the week when Shabbat is over? No, of course not. But the point that is being conveyed here is that whatever we do not finish in 6 days is to wait until the first day of the week. It is not to be done on the seventh day. All our work should be completed in the 6 days and not carry over into the seventh, the Shabbat, which is to be kept holy. So coming back to our passage in Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 14 then says in the Hebrew, Vayom hashvi'i Shabbat le-yod-he-vav-he Elohecha. This literally means, and day 7, Shabbat to Adonai your Elohim. This is, as we discussed in our last episode, yet another claim that the Sabbath belongs to Adonai. I cannot stress enough how important this concept is for us to understand. The Sabbath is Adonai's. He invites us to participate in it. He's going to participate in the Shabbat whether we decide to or not, but it's almost like when he tells us to keep it holy that he's saying, listen, kids, this is my day of rest. Don't mess it up. Anyone who's a parent can identify with this. That feeling of, can I just take a nap for a few minutes? That's not to suggest that Adonai ever needs to take a break from us or stops listening to our prayers or anything like that. But the point that I'm trying to make here is that he's going to cease from his work and rest on this day. It's his day. And in his great goodness, he has invited us to participate in that same ceasing from labor and resting the way that he does it. Thus, we keep it holy, set apart, for it is a day that is different than all the other days of the week. So, what is work exactly, Daniel? How do we know without a shadow of a doubt what work is and to avoid doing it on Shabbat? Ah, that is the question, isn't it? Welcome to the centuries-old, hotly debated and contested argument. Even Yeshua was confronted with accusations of working on Shabbat. But we'll get into answering this question later, after we've looked at the entirety of the biblical account on this topic. So, back to verse 14. It says, in the Hebrew, Lo ta'asa kal melcha. Literally, this means, no do every work. Here we see, once again, the words kal and melcha joined together. All work. In case there was any question left over from verses 12 through 13, verse 14 makes it clear, no work is to be done on Shabbat. This is then reinforced by the prohibition that states that every single classification of people is prohibited from working. Not your son, not your daughter, neither your male or your female servants, none of your animals, not even the foreigner who is visiting your country is allowed to work on this day. No one. There's no wiggle room here. No one is exempt from this prohibition on working. Everyone, instead, is invited to have a day of rest and relaxation. Everyone is invited to kick back with the king on his day, regardless of what their status in the nation might be. It doesn't matter where you are on the totem pole of hierarchy. Even the beasts of burden are to rest, from the richest of royalty to the destitute, from the halls of the palace to the alleys where the homeless dwell. All are instructed to rest. Further, the language that's used here is directed toward those who are accustomed to having others work for them. The clear indication here in verse 14 is that even those who are accustomed to having staff wait on them hand and foot should give their staff the day off. No one is to be working on this day. Are there exceptions? No. And yes, but again, we'll talk about that at a later time. For now, let's get back to what else Deuteronomy chapter 5 says. Verse 15 gives further context for verse 14. It gives us the reminder, remember back when you were a slave? Remember how much you hated having to work nonstop? Remember how you had no workers' rights? No labor laws? No union to represent you? Remember how you were forced to work 7 days a week, sunrise to sunset, every day of the year? Yeah, don't treat others in that same fashion. Sometimes we need reminders like that. Sometimes all we can see is the goals we're attempting to accomplish. Sometimes we need to be reminded that the ends don't always justify the means, that there are ways to work hard and ways to work smart. Sometimes they overlap, but sometimes they just don't. If our efforts to work hard end up alienating and disenfranchising others around us, then we need to cease from that type of behavior. It's an easy trap to fall into, where we consider our goals and our plans to be of greater consequence than the people who are helping us to achieve those very goals. We should always be mindful that it's not what we accomplish in life that's important. It's how we treat others that is of utmost importance. This is the message behind the parable that Yeshua tells in Matthew chapter 25. In Matthew chapter 25, verses 31 through 46, Yeshua tells his disciples a parable about what the coming judgment will be like. To paraphrase that passage, Yeshua says that he will separate the sheep from the goats. The sheep, he says, are those who fed and clothed the homeless, who visited those who were sick and who were in prison, and who showed hospitality towards strangers. It's these sheep who treated others with kindness, love, and compassion, who will hear from him, "Come, you who are blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundations of the world." But then there's this other group, the goats. This group of people did not feed and clothe the homeless, nor did they visit those who were sick or in prison, nor did they show hospitality towards strangers. Yeshua tells these goats that to the extent that they did not do these things toward others, even to the least of them, that they treated him with the same lack of regard and consideration. These goats will then be sentenced to the fire that has been prepared for the adversary and his angels. Yeshua says that they will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. This should speak volumes to us. Yeshua calls the sheep, the people who showed kindness, love, and compassion to others, the righteous. This sets a very interesting tone for us. We know that no one is righteous in their own efforts, that we all end up failing many times in our attempts to pursue perfection. Yet here in Matthew 25, the clear indication is that if we walk in kindness, love, and compassion, that we will eventually stand before him justified, being considered as righteous. It's the same mentality that is being conveyed to us here in Deuteronomy chapter 5. We are to remember to treat others the way we desire to be treated. We are to consider even the least of these, the servants, the cattle, the foreigner, and we are to treat them all with kindness, with love, and with compassion. Every living thing should be treated with kindness. If he was good enough to extend kindness toward us, we should extend that same kindness toward others. So this final instruction from the Torah in regards to Shabbat causes us to focus on several things. First, recognizing that this day belongs to Adonai. Second, that he has invited us to participate in it the way that he has and the way that he does. Third, that this is a day that's unlike the other 6 days of the week. It's holy, and we're to keep it that way, set apart and special. Fourth, that we are to accomplish all of our work in 6 days and to cease altogether from any type of work. Fifth, we're to remember that we were once slaves, subjected to cruel labor, and that we should treat those that are under our authority with the type of kindness, love, and compassion that we desire to have shown to ourselves. And finally, sixth, that all of Elohim's creations, regardless of status or prestige, are worthy of consideration and to be treated fairly. And you thought Shabbat was just a command to stop working for a day, huh? Now, we've discussed fully every verse found in the Torah about the Sabbath. So there's nothing left to discuss here, right? Unfortunately, that's exactly the sentiment I've witnessed being expressed by far too many fellow believers I've encountered. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, if we rely only on the verses found within the Torah that speak about Shabbat, we will end up having only a partial understanding of the significance of, as well as the application of, Shabbat. While there is obviously much to discuss about this topic from the verses that we've already covered, there are a whole lot more verses about Shabbat that we can gain a much fuller understanding from. Far too often, I have spoken with fellow believers who claim to keep the Sabbath holy, but who have failed to look past the Torah and see what else the other 61 books of the Bibles have to say on the topic of Shabbat. This, unfortunately, can end up causing confusion and frustration in fellowships as people end up at different understandings of what Shabbat is and isn't, and what should be permissible behavior on Shabbat, and what shouldn't be, etc., etc. So, what are these other verses that discuss the topic of Shabbat that we can glean from? Thanks for asking that question. So let's look at the next time in Scripture we see Shabbat mentioned. Although the book of Nehemiah takes place chronologically after the major prophets, in most English Bibles, the book of Nehemiah appears before those prophets. Nehemiah and Ezra led the reconstruction of the Second Temple after the days of the Babylonian captivity. As Nehemiah was attempting to reestablish the Jewish community and presence in the land of Israel while simultaneously constructing the temple after it had been destroyed by the Babylonians, he came up against some challenges in trying to install civil and moral order. We see this being played out for us in Nehemiah chapters 9 and 10. In chapter 9, the people confess their sins and the iniquities of their fathers. It was, after all, the sins of their fathers that led to the Babylonian captivity in the first place. Specifically, failing to honor the sabbatical year and the Yovel, the Jubilee years. Nehemiah chapter 9 is actually a great chapter to read to see the mentality of those who had returned to the land and their passion to serve Adonai. So at the end of chapter 9, and going into chapter 10, the Levites and the leaders of the children of Israel who had returned to the land, they decided to make a new constitution, so to speak. In this new constitution, they agree together that they will not follow in the ways of their fathers to break the commands of Torah, but instead, they will endeavor to keep and maintain all the instructions laid out for them in the Torah. This brings us to chapter 10, verses 28 through 30, which says, "Now the rest of the people, the priests, the Levites, the gatekeepers, the singers, the temple servants, and all those who had separated themselves from the peoples of the lands to the Torah of Elohim, their wives, their sons, and their daughters, all those who had knowledge and understanding, are joining with their kinsmen, their nobles, and taking on themselves a curse and an oath to walk in Elohim's Torah, which was given through Moshe, Elohim's servant, and to keep and to observe all the commandments of Adonai Elohim and his ordinances and his statutes, and that we will not give our daughters to the peoples of the land or take their daughters for our sons." This was a pretty serious statement that was being made here. These people were all pledging themselves to maintain loyalty and steadfastness to the Torah of Adonai. They were accepting that if they failed to do so the same way their fathers had, that they would suffer the same fate their fathers had. They'd be banished from the Promised Land. As part of this pledge, we then read this in verse 31. "As for the peoples of the land who bring wares or any grain on the Sabbath day to sell, we will not buy from them on the Sabbath or a holy day, and we will forego the crops of the seventh year and the exaction of every debt." In addition to pledging to maintain the sabbatical years, the seventh year, and the Yovel, the reference to the exaction of every debt, they also pledged to avoid purchasing anything on Shabbat or any holy day, a feast day. "As for the peoples of the land who bring wares or any grain on the Sabbath day to sell, we will not buy from them on the Sabbath day or a holy day." Now, when we read the prohibitions about Shabbat from the Torah, it was abundantly clear that no type of work was to happen. But there was no reference to buying or selling. So why would the Hebrews who returned from the Babylonian captivity make this pledge not to buy or sell on Shabbat? Were they adding to the Torah? Not at all. Remember Deuteronomy chapter 5? Remember that part about how no one could work on Shabbat? Not your son, not your daughter, neither your male or your female servant, none of your animals, not even the foreigner who is visiting your country is allowed to work on this day? No one. In this scenario, That would include the foreign merchants among them. So what the people were saying here was that they understood the prohibition against the foreigner working on Shabbat from Deuteronomy chapter 5 was to apply to the foreigners who regularly traveled through the region. These merchants would show up in Israel with goods from other lands, and they would have them to trade and to sell. What this pact stated was that the Israelites would not conduct business with them on Shabbat or on a feast day. Despite making this pledge, however, Nehemiah was forced to remind the Hebrews just 3 chapters later about the oaths that they had pledged. We see this in Nehemiah chapter 13. This is from verses 15 through 22, where it says, "In those days, I saw in Judah some who were treading the wine presses on the Sabbath, and bringing in sacks of grain and loading them on donkeys, as well as wine, grapes, figs, and all kinds of loads, and they brought them into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. So I admonished them on the day they sold food. Also, men of Tyre were living there, who imported fish and all kinds of merchandise, and sold them to the sons of Judah on the Sabbath, even in Jerusalem. Then I reprimanded the nobles of Judah and said to them, 'What is this evil you are doing by profaning the Sabbath day? Did not your fathers do the same, so that our Elohim brought on us and on this city all this trouble? Yet you are adding to the wrath on Israel by profaning the Sabbath.' It came about, just as it grew dark at the gates of Jerusalem before Sabbath, I commanded that the doors should be shut and that they should not open them until after the Sabbath. Then I stationed some of my servants at the gate, so that no load of water would enter on the Sabbath day. Once or twice, the traders and merchants of every kind of merchandise spent the night outside Jerusalem. Then I warned them and said to them, 'Why do you spend the night in front of the wall? If you do so again, I will use force against you.' From that time on, they did not come on the Sabbath. And I commanded the Levites that they should purify themselves and come as gatekeepers to sanctify the Sabbath day. For this also remember me, O my Elohim, and have compassion on me according to the greatness of your loving kindness." Oof. Nehemiah wasn't playing games here. What happened? How had the people forgotten their oaths so quickly? Well, what had happened was that over a decade of time passed between Nehemiah chapter 10 and Nehemiah chapter 13. You see, once the wall around Jerusalem had been built and dedicated, Nehemiah was obligated to return to Persia, as he had sworn to do so before leaving Persia for the land of Israel to begin the reconstruction project. But we see in chapter 13, verses 6 through 14, the verses just before what we just read, that Nehemiah returns to Jerusalem after 12 years of being back in Persia. When he returns, Nehemiah found that the priests had not honored the sanctity of the temple, so he goes through the process of cleansing the temple and admonishes the Levites to make sure things were on the up and up. So, somehow, during the 12 years that Nehemiah was gone, the Hebrews resorted to committing the same sins that had sent their fathers into captivity. It wasn't even like it was a generation later, like their children had failed to walk in the ways they taught them or something. It was the same people who swore the oath in chapter 10 who ended up breaking their word and turning back to their sinful ways. This is why Nehemiah gets so stern with the merchants who camped out on Friday night outside of Jerusalem's city walls, hoping to conduct business on Shabbat. If you can imagine how you would react toward the drug dealer who had been preying on your addicted child, you can understand why Nehemiah threatened the merchants with physical violence if they didn't leave. The point of all this, however, is to illustrate that Nehemiah clearly understood that business was not to be conducted on Shabbat. But that isn't explicitly stated in the Torah. Upon what was Nehemiah's interpretation based? That's more of a holistic answer rather than a specific verse. Remember, Exodus 16, we were instructed that every man should stay in his own place on Shabbat. Remember how we were instructed to bake what you will bake and boil what you will boil. Remember how we were instructed to not go out and attempt to collect manna on Shabbat. Remember Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5, where we're instructed that no one may work, even the foreigner who is among us. Remember Exodus 35, where we were instructed not to kindle a fire on Shabbat because that constituted work? Remember Numbers 15, where the same law applied to the native-born and the foreigner? All these instructions regarding Shabbat, all found within the Torah, weave together a tapestry that conveys the single overriding message: Shabbat is kadosh, holy, set apart, different. Shabbat is not like all the other days, and it shouldn't be treated like it's just another ordinary day. Nehemiah determined that if it's expected that we not leave our place on Shabbat, that we not cook our food on Shabbat, that if we not cause even the animals to work, never mind all humans are prohibited from working, whether they're a member of Israel or not, then it's only logical to suggest that merchants not be allowed to sell their goods. If you're going out of your home to meet the merchants, you're breaking the commands. If you make the merchants sell you their wares, they're working. Thus, you're breaking the commands. To put this concept in more modern terms, this description sure sounds like, going out to eat at a restaurant on Shabbat, doesn't it? I mean, if you leave your house on Shabbat to go eat at a restaurant, isn't that similar to attempting to gather manna on Shabbat? Something we were instructed not to do? Isn't making the waitstaff at the restaurant serve you similar to the merchants coming into Jerusalem to offer their wares on Shabbat? But Daniel, you might say, those people, they're not keeping Shabbat in the first place. They're already working on Shabbat. Even if I didn't go to the restaurant, they'd still be working. So I'm not making them work because they're already doing that. So do you think that line of thought would have convinced Nehemiah? I mean, the merchants were already working by traveling to Jerusalem. By just letting them into the city, they were already working anyway, so we wouldn't be making them work if we just bought some stuff from them, because they're already working, right? Yeah, not only would Nehemiah not have accepted that line of logic, but it was that very type of thought that led the Hebrews to abandon keeping Shabbat in those 12 short years when Nehemiah was in Persia. Further, if you will recall from Deuteronomy chapter 5, we discussed that the perspective that was being addressed was that it was a prohibition against making people work for you on Shabbat. That's why the language in Deuteronomy 5 expands on the instruction found in Exodus chapter 20. Specifically, no one was to work for you on Shabbat. Not your children, not your servants, not your cattle, not even the foreigners. When we start attempting to justify others working for us by pointing out that they're already working, it's akin to committing the same errors that the Hebrews made in the 12 years that Nehemiah was away. It would also be akin to a citizen of Jerusalem defying Nehemiah's instructions and going outside of the city walls in order to purchase from the merchants that were outside waiting. This was the very reason Nehemiah warned the merchants to not even show up on Friday evening. He was intentionally attempting to remove the temptation that the Hebrews would face to break the commands regarding Shabbat. If the merchants weren't there, the people would be much less likely to be tempted to go out of their homes in order to purchase. But if we go back to Nehemiah chapter 13, we also saw that the Hebrews were themselves working on Shabbat when Nehemiah returned from Persia. They were treading the winepress. They were loading their sacks of grain. They were loading up their donkeys and generally disregarding the instructions to cease from labor on that day. Nehemiah rebuked them for all these activities. As we continue to move forward through the scriptures and what they have to say about this topic of Shabbat, we'll find that there are multiple other passages that Nehemiah would have been familiar with that further solidify his interpretation that no work was to be conducted on Shabbat, nor was there to be any buying and selling. But you'll have to wait until our next episode to hear about those. There's much more to cover on this topic. In our next episode, we'll examine what Adonai spoke through the prophets Isaiah and Jeremiah about this topic, and we'll flesh out a bit more how this should look in a modern context. Please make plans to join us for that episode. Until then, shalom.